The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Oh, good morning, everyone. Let's see, am I on? Is it loud enough? Maybe a little bit louder? Let's see, is that better? Okay, good. So, this morning I'd like to interpret a particular teaching from the Buddha that perhaps is not taught so much in the West, but if you look back at the early Buddhist texts, it's one of the more important teachings that he had to offer. And that is a teaching around something called, in English, the five aggregates. And the word is, translating as aggregates, is khanda. And khanda is just kind of a simple word, I think, meaning like a bundle or a bunch of stuff. And so somehow they have settled on aggregate as the translation in English. So the five bundles, five bunches of stuff. And why it's important is that insight into these five aggregates is liberating, is one of the means for freedom in Buddhism. And one of the primary goals of Buddhist practice is freedom. And the idea of bondage and freedom is one of the metaphors that this early Buddhist tradition uses. We don't use the word bondage very much in the West to talk about our state, but we use words like caught up. I was really caught up in whatever I was doing. That person's really stuck. They're stuck in their ways, stuck in their views. Someone's really stuck. Usually we're not stuck, but we're just caught up. Or sometimes we talk about being limited, being, so we're living under limitations. I feel really limited, confined. So the idea of being confined, limited, stuck, caught, there's probably other words that we use that are more our contemporary words that talk to the same thing. And so then we can become unstuck, uncaught, unlimited, unconfined. We open up. That's a very common word in the West. We become open, and that feels like a good thing. And but this movement towards being uncaught, unstuck, one of the means for the early tradition was to have insight into these five aggregates. And I'll tell you later what they are. But first I would like to offer you an analogy. Maybe some of you had kids. Some years ago when my kids were young, there was a Japanese illustrated kids' book. It had no words. And it was had to do with the power of 10. And each page would zoom in or zoom out by powers of 10. And it was fascinating to watch everything change and turn the page, and it's like a whole different view. So you have the drama of your life. I'm sure you have important things going on that you're concerned with. Someone else might say you're stuck with, you're caught up in. But you have your things that you're concerned with, and some of you know that because when you sit down to meditate, you try to let go of them, but your mind keeps going back to those. You're stuck there. You're caught up in that. You're preoccupied. And some of our stories, the events of our life, are pretty dramatic. And some are very painful and difficult, for sure. And some are very captivating and compelling. So all kinds of things. So you take your life, and then you begin to zoom out. So first you maybe zoom out to the second floor of a building and look down at your life. It's still pretty interesting down there. You're kind of still involved. And then you zoom up to the 10th floor, and it's still you down there, and it's your like little thing, drama, and how's it going to turn out? And you're still interested. Then you zoom out to the outer orbit of the planet, and you can't see yourself anymore down there, but this is like, wow, the Earth. Wow, this is fascinating. And you're still thinking about your story, your event, she said that, he did this, I really have to respond, do something, I have to pay my taxes. But wow, The Earth. Wow, this is quite something to be up here. And then you zoom out further. Let's say you go to the moon. And like, wow, it's a beautiful blue thing floating in space. It's vast space. You know, it's beautiful. Wow. Yeah. You get the phone call on your cell phone. It says, you know, you have the story back at Earth. That's really important. Because we take cell phones everywhere now, right? So... And so, you know, you say, not now, please. And you're like, wow, that's great, right? So you zoom out enough, and the drama of your life somehow you have a different perspective on it, and it's like a whole different thing. Or you're in the scale of your drama, your life, your things, what's important for you, your history, all your things, your pain, your suffering. And instead of zooming out, you zoom in. So... you have your story, you're having some conflict with someone, and they're there. And you zoom in, and you get their face. But let's change the image a little bit. Let's say you're watching a movie. You're in the theater, or watching on a computer, probably. And you're really involved in the movie. It's a wonderful movie, terrible movie, frightening movie. And you're like, you can't wait to see what's happening. You're all tense. Or you're all excited and anticipating. It's like this movie has really pulled you in. That's another way we say, you know, I've been stuck. I was pulled in. So we're pulled in. Maybe it feels nice, maybe it doesn't feel nice, but we're pulled in. And then someone sitting next to you takes your computer and zooms in. And it zooms in. Now you see the face of the main character. And you're still, they're here, they're talking, and you're still involved. You see the gesture, the facial expressions, and you're still involved. It's still interesting. And then they zoom in, all you see is the nose. It's kind of, you're aware of the story, the event, the movie still, and the nose is moving around as they talk, you know. And then they zoom in further, and you see the pores and the hair, you know, on the nose, the teeny little hair. And like the story, what's going on, begins to recede. But then they zoom in further, and all you start seeing is the pixels. And of this movie, right? So you see the pixels, and like there's no story and event. It's like just color patches. They rise and they pass, and just it's pixels. And at that point, some point as you zoom in, at some point, you realize the story is not happening anymore. And the tension, the involvement, the kind of like eagerness, the whatever way, or the horror, pulling back, it relaxes. So whether you zoom out and you have this great spacious view from the moon, and that gets you to relax out from the hotness of your story, or whether you zoom in and see the amazing, you know, details of inner workings of your cells almost, at some point, you relax. You let go of your involvement with the story, the drama, the events, the existential issues, whatever's going on. That moment when you let go, when you relax and settle back, that's a very important moment. The moment when you experience the relief of the release. And Buddhism says, pay attention to that. Pay attention to those moments when you relax and let go. At any scale, at any degree that you can do it, pay attention to that. Now, some people will, in fact, let go and relax, but the habit of not paying attention to that is quite strong. And so their mind rushes back to the story, the memory, the ideas, the planning, whatever, out there, the things. Or some people will say, well, the world is an important place. I want to celebrate the world. I want to acknowledge the world. That's what's important to be. And they don't pay attention to this inner letting go that's happened. Buddha says, pay attention to this. In fact, if you can find a way to let go deeply, this is very good for you and the world. And then the task is you let go really deeply. If you really let go of the caughtness, the stuckness, then the task is how to return to the world, how to zoom in or zoom out, depending which way you went. And come back into your story, your events, the things going on in your life, how you are, and see if you can stay uncaught while you're involved and engaged in it. And this idea of going back and experimenting with trying to be, you know, connected is a very important part of this process. Some Buddhists will let go very deeply. Some meditators let go very deeply. And in that letting go, will over-validate the state of letting go and say, well, that world out there that I was involved in, that doesn't count. That's not important. I'm not going to be involved anymore. I'm going to be aloof. I'm going to kind of just float on a cloud. I'm going to go become a monastic and live in a cave or something. And that's not a very, you know, that space creates separation. The idea is to experience this peace and then experiment, learn, practice to bring it back and have that as you live your life. So sometimes the practice is about temporarily leaving, stepping out of your life so you experience this peace. And then sometimes the practice is stepping back into this world so you can experiment with maintaining that peace. Many years ago, there was a friend of mine who had a bunch of young Tibetan monks staying at her house. I think they were pretty young. They wanted to watch on her TV an American horror movie. And what the reason they wanted to do it was they wanted to see if they could, they had this practice of open, relaxed awareness. And they wanted to see if they can have their relaxed, open, non-reactive awareness operating as they watch the horror movie. That was going to be their exercise because they didn't have TV back, this was the 1980s, back in wherever they came from, so. That's what they said they were doing. So this exercise of coming back and trying to find out how do we live in this world without being caught again? So this teachings on the five aggregates is a teaching about the primary places we get caught, we get stuck, and learning to have insight into them so that we can get uncaught. And there's certainly a variety of ways of doing it, but in the Vipassana tradition, it's mostly done by zooming in. It's possible to zoom out and have that kind of broad panoramic view, but the Vipassana practice is primarily about zooming in. And so the five aggregates are useful to think of before I tell you what they are. You're sitting on the edge of your chair. Good. Keep that way, and then when I tell you, you relax, and then you have that experience. analogy for the five aggregates would be someone's house. Say it's a little bit, they have a large house. And when someone comes into that house, anybody comes into the house, maybe goes through the door, the front door, say. And once they're in through the front door, they're in the hallway. If they go further in, they come to the parlor. If they go further in, they come to the living room. They go further in, they come to the kitchen. And they go all the way in, they come to the bedroom, the most intimate part of the house. So if you're just a salesperson, you don't even get in through the door. You get to knock on the door and they open it. Some people get, you know, to come into the hallway. Some people come in from the hallway into the parlor. And in the old way of parlors, perhaps, is the people who you're most formal with, where you have a role, they have a role, and you play your role in the parlor. But the people who you're better friends with, you invite them into the living room. And they have a different, and your roles perhaps aren't so important, like, you know, their profession, but you kind of let go and more relaxed. And then you go deeper in and you become, the kitchen, and that's where, you know, for your life, all the stories go on, all the exciting stuff and family dynamics and go on, you know, that's where a lot happens in the kitchen. But then you can go all the way into the bedroom, and that's where you can really relax and be yourself and put it all down. It's really great. So you come in, and there's a kind of going in. So the five aggregates are kind of like seen this way as a way of going deeper and deeper into your own experience of this world that we're living in, the direct experience. So the first aggregate is has to do with, it's a door to all our experiences, door in. Everything that we experience through the sense doors. So there's contact, there's touch. So we touch things through our body and we feel the contact. But we touch things, you know, in the old way, old times they talk sometimes that you touch things with your eyes. there's perception through your eyes, or the ears, or the nose, or the tongue. And also the mind door that Buddhism posits, that there's some kind of door, a window in the mind from which you can perceive what goes on in the mind, your thoughts and your feelings and emotions and all that. And so everything in all our world experiences, everything that we know, has to come in through those doors. You know, how are you going to know the world without having some perception of it? So that's the door, the contact that happens. Once you've let it into your hallway, going a little bit, step in into yourself more deeply, then the next aggregate has to do about the very simplest ways in which you register a feeling about that contact, what's happened. So kind of how, do you like it, do you not like it, is it pleasant, is it unpleasant? It's a subjective experience of what it's like to have that impact of that contact. So if there's a loud, unpleasant sound, the hearing is where the contact happens, and with it deeper inside is, oh, that's unpleasant. And some experiences, you know that it's subjective because the same experience, one person can experience as pleasant and another person experience unpleasant. Or in different circumstances, it's pleasant and unpleasant. And so there's a subjective way we're involved, our interpretations, our history, our memory, come into play about this subjective way in which we register it in the most simple, basic way. Okay? If you go further in, into the parlor, then it's the what's called the labels that we put on it. You know, what we call it, the name for it. So we experience something, we feel that it's pleasant or unpleasant, but then we have a label for what it is. There's a loud sound outside, and a big pop, and we assume that it's a backfire of a car. So we label it, that's a backfire, it's a backfire of a car. But this week, we had to repair our air conditioning, and we have our unit just outside this wall here, outside, and the repairman came back in and showed us this capacitor, I think he called it, this little cylinder, metal cylinder, and he showed me how it was bulging, about to explode. And I don't know what happened, so I can imagine if it exploded, it could have made a big popping sound. And I would have been sitting in here thinking it was a backfire of a car, but I misidentified what it was. It could have been the exploding capacitor thing, right? So we have, sometimes our labels are accurate enough, useful enough, sometimes they're not. So this room here that we're sitting in, we now call it a meditation hall. And some of you might call it the meditation hall. This used to be a church, and this was a sanctuary. It wasn't used for meditation. Or we could, you know, turn it around. There was a church that we wanted to buy in Palo Alto before we bought this one, that the people who did buy it turned it into an architect's office, office building for architects. So this sanctuary of that church now has become, you know, architect's office. So these things are fluid, what we label them, and we change it all the time. We have a yoga that happens in here. I can imagine someone who's never been here before knocks at the door and says, I heard there's yoga. And they say, oh, the yoga room, seeing everyone who's doing yoga here. So it's a label. And labels have a really important in our lives, because how we label things is often how we then respond further. So if you're walking down the street and see someone who's big and dirty and ferocious looking, you put a label, that's a dangerous person, or that's a bad person. And so with that label, then we begin to react as if that label is true. Sometimes people have a lot of prejudice. These labels come up very strongly about who people are that is causes a lot of suffering. So the first aggregate is the contact with the world, the sense contact. The second is how it feels in the most primitive, simple way. The third is the label we put on it. The fourth is when you come into the living room and then deeper into the kitchen, that's where life begins kind of more complicated and the full drama and everything begins happening maybe. This is all the stories we start making, the interpretations, the commentary we start making about the experience. So we have the experience, we have the feeling of it, we have the labels we assign it, and then based on that, we start having much more involved mental fabrications, mental world of ideas, commentary, interpretations, stories, and so forth. And sometimes this world of stories and interpretations has long since lost any real contact with the real world. We're living in fantasy and just wandering off and off. It can be a huge part of human life, this world of the inner thinking and feeling and imagining that goes on. So these first four are usually translated into English as the aggregate of form, the aggregate of feeling, the aggregate of perception, and the aggregate of mental formations. And then the fifth one, when you really get into the inner sanctum, the bedroom or something, that's your consciousness. And what exactly consciousness is in Buddhism, I don't know. I wish I do. I don't think even modern neuroscientists don't really know what consciousness is. There's all kinds of theories, but every new book has a little different theory what it is. But it's good enough to have a vague idea. But consciousness, the word vijnana means that dividing knowing or distinguishing knowing, discriminating knowing, and it's that which can separate out all this. So in ordinary life, we're caught up and involved. It all kind of happens all in a big, mess. It just happens in a big bundle, thing. But then when we start doing meditation, for example, one way, and get calm and relaxed and focused and mindful, then consciousness begins doing its work better, which is to begin distinguishing what's going on. It begins zooming in. So rather than seeing yourself as, here I am, Gil is a complicated, my association with Gil are complicated, right? And I can just treat it as a unitary single thing, Gil. But if I zoom in to Gil, as I zoom in far enough and calm enough, then I'm in the present moment experiencing myself in the present. Not experiencing myself through the filter of my memories and plannings and all that, but just here. And as I zoom in closer, then I begin distinguishing that there's just different elements of my present moment experience. There's the contact of the moment, the perception, the immediate kind of experience that happens. There's the sense doors. There's the feeling I have about that. There's the labels I put in that experience. And then there's the stories, ideas, interpretations I add to that. And then there's a consciousness that can distinguish and see all that. And consciousness is kind of, some people have a sense of consciousness being a field, open field of awareness within which things occur. Because once you start distinguishing the different elements, then there's space between them. And when there's space, there's space. There's spacious, in that sense of spacious awareness, has the word spacious, right? Open awareness, wide awareness, as a kind of spacious quality. It's one of the reasons people find it so meaningful, is it's a relaxed, peaceful, spacious quality to it sometimes. So we zoom in and we start seeing what's actually going on in the moment. Before we put it into one big bundle, we see what's made up of these smaller bundles. And so as we look at this, at what point do we zoom into these different parts we're not living in the middle of the story and drama of our life, the interpretations, and begin relaxing and stepping back. So, for example, we're thinking the mental formations. At what point are you calm enough, still enough, mindful enough, that you can see a thought when it arises, and you can see when it passes? When we're going around busy in life, thoughts just are, you know, a mile a minute or 60 miles a minute or something. They just appear, and we don't have any sense that they are. You know, we're more involved in the content of the thoughts, and we believe the thoughts, we're caught in the thoughts, and thoughts are true or whatever. But it's quite something to watch a thought arise in the moment and pass away. It's a very powerful thing to see, because if you see the genesis of a thought, then you can put a question mark behind it. Is this really true? And so, for example, that dangerous person walking down the street, you can see you're walking around, your mind is calm or whatever, and you see the person. So seeing the person is, the seeing is the first aggregate. There's a way in which that's experienced subjectively as being pleasant or unpleasant. Maybe in this case there's a sense of unpleasantness. And then there's a label, a thought that arises, a dangerous person. And then there's all this mental formation, just thinking, I better run away, I better, you know, call the police, I better vote for a different political party. You know, whatever, it goes on. And, you know, it gets, you know, the mind does those things. But if you see the arising of this label, dangerous person, then you can say, wait a minute, that's something that's happening in my mind. It may or may not be an accurate interpretation of the situation. Let me look more carefully. Let me give it a second look. And maybe you find out the person is dangerous. Or maybe you find out that the reason you think they're dangerous is because you associated it with your, you know, Uncle Eddie, who was always a bully. You know, he looks just like it. And so, oh, that's not Uncle Eddie, but, you know. And so you can check it out. It's very powerful to do that. Or you notice that because you're quiet enough, you notice the label. And then you see that you start telling yourself stories around it and spinning out. And you notice that you're spinning out in stories, you've lost touch with what's happening on the street. And if the person is dangerous, don't get lost in fantasy. Stay present. But some people, that's where they start panicking, perhaps, if there's danger, right, or something. And it's quite something to get to watch the, you know, the whole world of mental formations and have that bubble pop. So I had the bubble pop once when I sat a 3-month retreat, 3 months of silence with 80 other people. And and there's something on these retreats, a phenomenon called Vipassana romances. It happens so often that people just call it VRs. where you're sitting next to, you know, seeing somebody, someone's on the retreat, and you kind of fall in love with them. You know, this is the person. So that happened to me on this 3-month retreat. And, you know, I never talked to her, and we just passed each other sometimes. I mostly had my eyes closed, but you know, I wasn't really obsessing or stuck on her, but there were, you know, 3 months is a long time, so the relationship developed. And, you know, and so we got to know each other, and we started dating, and then we got engaged, and got married, and divorced. It was great. And then at the very end of the retreat last week, we broke silence and we were sitting in a big circle and people got to speak and say some words about the retreat. And I heard her speak for the first time. And it turned out she had a very thick foreign accent. And I had this whole fantasy about her being an American. And in that moment, my whole fantasy, my whole bubble thought from my just pop. I realized, I don't know who this person is whatsoever. And I had created a whole inner world that had no basis really in reality. That was kind of humbling. So to zoom in and start seeing how this operates. And one of the benefits of meditation, as we get calmer and less involved in our thoughts, they don't necessarily stop, but thoughts get lighter and lighter. Thoughts get more insubstantial. They become wispy or cloud-like, as opposed to solid and important and urgent and, you know, have a lot of authority. And so we see this world of thinking, this mental formation. We see it still operates, but, you know, we just let it be. We don't get involved, it just floats by, and we're not oppressed by it. So we see the arising and passing, we see the impermanence. As we get into this kind of, get closer and closer, zoom in to the five aggregates to see the distinction between these different parts of our experience, then we have a chance also to see that it arises and passes. Some of these things are very fleeting. Our sense experiences are fleeting. They're constantly being renewed and changing. Our subjective experience of pleasant and unpleasant. Turns out if you're really calm and present and focused, you see there's actually a kaleidoscope of movement and arising and passing. Our labels, you know, can you can see is really fleeting. There was no label, you made one, and you lived with it for a while, and then it, you know. So this, you know, for me, I lived with this, it wasn't that fleeting, this woman, she was an American for 3 months. That was my label, but I kept that label. But what I kept doing, I wasn't thinking about it all the time. So there'd be a moment I'd see her in the dining room and have a label, and then I wouldn't see her or go away or just be there a little bit fleeting, right? Labels appear and come and go. And if you're quiet enough and zoomed in enough, you see that thoughts come and go. They arise and they pass. And if you're calm enough, you see that also not only they arise and pass, but there's a little space between your thoughts, a gap, the moments of silence, or quarter moments of silence, just a little bit. And to have some sense of space between your thoughts is very interesting. One of the ways it's interesting is, who are you in that space? Who are you when there's no thoughts to tell you? Have you ever thought about that? If you don't have thoughts, thoughts are not available to tell you who you are. Who are you? What happens when you go in there and just kind of... And what we say in Buddhism is that if you go into that, find that gap, rest in it. Let go into it, see what happens. And so you see the arising and passing of thoughts and you're not so caught in it. Or you're aware of consciousness. Consciousness also, if you can see occasionally, is arising and passing. And this is important because some people take consciousness as ultimate and they get stuck and caught in consciousness. And so at some point, as we zoom into our experience, you know, from the normal way in which we're involved in our life, sit down, focused, and we start making distinction between the aggregates, the rising and passing, we zoom into it, at some point we have that experience of letting go. We're no longer interested or involved temporarily with the usual things we're caught up in our lives. And this is not to dismiss the importance of engaging with our life, but it's really useful, important, for the path of liberation to have this experience of deep release and relaxation, deep letting go, deep coming home and for the heart to be at home in itself, deep settled, being deeply settled. And because that becomes your teacher. That becomes a reference point from which to become more cognizant, more sensitive to what it's like when you start getting caught, when you start getting stuck on something. And it's very hard to even, sometimes some people don't even know they're stuck, right? And it's very hard to even know, and actually most people don't know how stuck they are. You might know you're stuck in some things, but there's very, very deep attachments that inside of us, attachment to self, for example, attachment to life. And so to really have to really discover that we're attached, stuck, it helps to have this very deep letting go that can happen in meditation if you do this kind of zooming in. But in order to zoom in, you have to be willing to change the resolution, whatever, change the magnification. If you always stay at the magnification level of your ordinary life and your thoughts and your drama and all that, then you're not going to see it in a new way. So there has to be a willingness temporarily to put it aside, or at least temporarily not be so invested in it. Temporarily say, this is not where I want to be right now. Not so easy to let go of it, stop it, but at least kind of like, you know, I don't really believe this is what I should be doing right now. Because you still, if you believe you should be doing it, then why would you change the zoom level? So then we change the zoom level and we come in. And the deeper you can zoom in, at some point, the deeper the letting go can happen. Deeper the release can happen. And the deeper the release, the better that experience is your teacher to teach you how you're stuck and how you get stuck again and how you get involved and caught up again. And you have a whole different way of studying yourself if you have that experience of letting go, of peace. And you know it's possible, and you're more aware of when you're stuck, and you're more aware of how you get stuck. You can watch the process arising and happening. And then at some point you can go back into the world, and you don't have to, you can still be fully engaged in the world and your friends and everything, but the difference is that now you're more at peace with it all. You can stay relaxed. And that's a good thing. The world is a better place if we're not stuck, if we're not caught. When we're caught, it's actually harder for everybody else, usually, except for this one man who came to IMC many years ago, an older man, maybe in his 70s. And he had grown children, and he'd spent his whole life, that his children knew him, being nervous, he told me. Got a nervous personality. And then he started coming here and meditating, and after some period of meditating, his kids kind of sat him down and said, Dad, we're concerned about you. You know, you might want to go to the doctor, you know, because, you know, you're old and, you know, something's happening here to you. And what happened was he was no longer nervous. Isn't that nice? Anyway, so sometimes the kids will worry. Some people will worry, but you have to reassure them it's okay. So the five aggregates, these five different streams or five different ways of looking at different aspects of our how we experience the world. We experience it through our senses, through how we feel about it, through how we label it, how we think about it, and then how we're conscious of it. They're all kind of general, broad consciousness of it. Each of those areas are places where people can get stuck, can get caught. We can get caught in the perceptions, we can get caught in the feelings, we can get caught in the labels, we can get caught in the stories, and we can get caught in the consciousness that knows it all. And by zooming in and really being mindful, it's possible to begin to let go of how we're caught, and then you can have this wonderful teacher, the teacher of non-caughtness. So, we have about 5 minutes near the end. If anyone has anything they want to ask or say, yes?
Could we use the mic?
I have a question about the aggregate of the sense doors. So, I'm familiar with, although I don't have it a lot, I'm familiar with thoughts, the arising of thoughts and seeing them arise, mostly at retreats, but more and more in my daily life. But I'm not, well, there's a hierarchy almost. I'm far less familiar with the other sense doors. Smell, I'm so unfamiliar with it that if I'm walking in a field and I smell the flowers, it gets my attention right away. Hearing, I pay no attention to it unless there's something loud.
So some people live very limited lives. And one way to be limited lives is to be caught up in the fourth aggregate, mental formations and thoughts. plannings and stories, and you know, that's, and you know, it's like when I was driving down 280, happened a couple of times in my life, and I was supposed to get off at Page Mill, and I missed the exit. And I was driving safe enough, but I was thinking about something really, probably very important. And that was the world I was living in. The exit, and it's a big deal, because the next exit is kind of far. So some people spend a lifetime kind of lost in this inner world. If it's really, really, really go far, then they have places where they'll house you. But, you know, you're basically, you know, you're basically coming out often enough and checking out the world that you're okay. But some people are imbalanced. I'm not saying it's you, but some people are imbalanced. And so one of the things mindfulness does is helps us bring us back into balance. So we're more balanced in the full range of who we are. So there are feelings, our perceptions, our experience of the world, our being in the present moment is much more inclusive rather than narrow to something, you know, one little world. And that's very important to do, because the stories we tell ourselves is often a source of our emotional happiness or unhappiness. So if we're caught up in the mental formations, the world of stories and ideas and commentary and judgments, we have to be very careful what those inner life is saying, the image it's making, because if we're stuck in certain directions, then it can be, you know, have consequences. Okay? Catherine? And this will be the last one.
Yeah, I've been reading a bit about the aggregates and read that really having insight into them, one sees the clinging that holds the aggregates together. And if one can see deeply into that, not just in a conventional understanding of it, but in a deeper way, that it falls apart and one becomes liberated. So I wanted to put that out there for comment. And also, you were talking about zooming in. Is there a way that zooming out can also be used as a strategy for liberation?
So it's nice, this idea that you can somehow have insight into all five aggregates and suddenly let go of, you know, they all fall apart, they cling to it. I don't know that for myself. I mean, for me, what I know is you really zoom in and be aware of where the clinging. Clinging is always kind of, I don't know about clinging to the whole show. Maybe it's possible, but that's not something I know so much about. And so if you look carefully, I'm clinging to particular ones of them. And so that's, you know, if you zoom in, you start seeing where the clinging is, the perceptions or thoughts or labels or whatever it might be. But once you see the clinging, so whether it's clinging to the whole, all five, or clinging to particular aspects of it, it's the release of that that brings the freedom. And then can you zoom out? Yes. I think that loving kindness practice, the meditation on love, is a way of zooming out, because the mind becomes expansive and broad and unlimited mind. It's very big and spacious and open, and that open big space is another place one can then relax into and let go. And some other meditation experiences also provide very big, panoramic, broad, open, spacious kind of, you know, space-like awareness. And that also can give a very different sense of way of relating to these things. So, and many years ago when I was a new Zen student, I remember some Zen priest told me that he made the claim that there were two paths. There was the path that zooms in and finds that there's no self, and the path that zooms out and says that everything is self. And so both, he claimed it was supposed to lead to the same thing. You let go, finally. I don't know if his analysis, how accurate it is, but I was struck at the time, this idea that, you know, two different ways to go. And Buddhism tends to go on the zooming in, tends to go into discovering that what we think is self is not self. And but you know, there could be the other way as well. Okay, so I hope this talk supports you in being less caught, and you'll do the world a favor if you're less caught. Thank you.